How are you feeling?
Much better.
Good.
Yeah.
You're still stuffy.
Yeah, I'm still a mess, but that's normal the course for me getting sick.
Yeah.
Barb got it bad too.
Oh,
Couple
does she usually
I got
get
her
sick too, or
sick.
no?
Not well, I don't know, sometimes. She's got a better immune system than I do. So, Chris, are you there? I keep getting
Oh, butt heads.
a weird cat thumbs up.
I was getting there too.
I
My
thought it
cat's
was a
not weird.
I thought it was a virus. I was gonna delete it. I
No,
keep
these
getting
are
this.
reactions. I'm reacting.
Oh. They're freaking me out, man.
The new Skype. Yeah, I downloaded it, installed a new one when I logged in.
It didn't for me, so I hope you're recording, Chris.
It didn't for me either. I think Rob's
It
just
said I
out of
needed it
date.
said I needed to, but I was like, I don't
Yeah.
want to do it. Until they
Didn't
start
even give me a
making.
choice. I just double-clicked Skype, and the first thing it said was installing.
Yeah, you sometimes it doesn't.
That's fine.
I'd like to go back to the Skype that we had when we started the show.
Yeah, that was a good Skype. It lasted for many years. And you never What was
had to
that? Tin
upgrade.
cans and a string?
Well, you never had to upgrade unless you really forced to. I don't think with this new Skype that you can even tell it like, "Hey, don't install the new one." Before you could like block it.
Even a few things ago, it would just keep asking me, and I would just ignore it over and over again.
Yeah. Sorry, I was the late one.
Oh, that's
I was a
fine.
little late to the party. Usually I'm on time, but I wanted to finish reading my first pre-90s Star Lord.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. This was from 1979, and I wanted to see what it was like.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it. It was pretty good. It was a magazine type format. It was good sci-fi. It wasn't great, but I enjoyed it. It was probably my least favorite of everything I read this weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 'cause it was just like a straightforward sci-fi story. It was he's in his ship, and it's weird because in his ship, it's more like a ship that's sort of sentient, like he could It sort of has life and he can control it like that. And then some black hole vortex like sucks him in and separates him from his ship. And it's this alien world and it's this huge ship that says they lie to him and they say they escaped Earth and Earth was destroyed. And really they're mining information about Earth so they can conquer it. And there's this sexy gal that says, "Join us and we'll fight the power." And she's all sexy. She looks Earth woman, but the smoke clears and she's got green skin and she looks like Gamora. Kind of, but she's like alien. And he still says, "Hey, let's get it on. Let's get it on." And they have sex. He starts the rebellion and then goes back into space. So it's pretty straightforward. It's pretty interesting magazine formats called Marvel Super Special Magazine. It's not his first appearance. I wish it was his first appearance. But it was by Doug Munch and Gene Colan and Tom Palmer, so the art was pretty solid. I mean, the creative team in general was, they're big names. And then the second story, I like the second story better because it's more like a Planet of the Apes type story, but it was by Mark Dacey and Ernie Colan. Cologne, and it's called To Sleep, Perchance to Die, and it's just by an astronaut that goes into space and sort of has this dream of two worlds fighting each other, and he's a hero on one of the worlds, and then he wakes up in his ship and he's like, "What just happened?" But it was my first Marvel mag.
That's cool.
And this one's interesting because it's in color. And I have bought some of these before, but the Marvel Super Special magazine was usually used for movie remakes. You know, that's where they like had their Conan book and all their other stuff. Red Sonja the movie. Matter of fact, one of them's worth a lot. Labyrinth. So I have a few of them. Like I have Meteor. That movie was out in the 70s, and I bought that. But this, I think, was the most like more original content than based off of media.
Cool. So, how's everyone's new year?
It was good. I heard yours was good. I listened to the
Yeah.
episode.
Yeah, I'm glad we got you back interested in comics. It's only been a couple weeks.
Hey, if I'm not interested in comics, you either know what two things. I'm probably dying. Or something really bad has happened
Yeah.
to vector my concentration away from them.
Well, you heard us announce last time that you had stopped collecting and buying
Yeah,
comics.
the
Yeah.
lies, all lies.
I don't think anybody believed it.
No, I don't think
Yeah,
so either.
I didn't believe it either. I just went along with Rob so he would feel better.
I got the first appearance of Metamorpho, Brave and the Bold 57. Mike, did you get yours as well?
Yeah, I got mine.
So that was exciting.
Yeah, it was one that I just never pulled the gun on, and I said, screw it, I'm just gonna buy it with my last order.
Yeah.
Mine was in really good shape. I got a good deal. I was pretty
It was.
happy with the condition, but with mycomicshop.com, I'm always happy with the way they grade. Like
Yeah, me too. I love to say that.
they grade down. They do like me. Like I'm on the side of caution when I sell something on eBay. I always like if it's very fine, I go fine. If it's near mint, I go very fine. I just drop it, and they seem to do the same thing. And their fines look damn near very fine to me.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of the ones that I've bought, like just filling holes of like inexpensive comics. The best that they'll have is very fine. I just buy the, even if they're, I'm talking like late Firestorm or Elementals. I mean, $1.60 each or something.
Yeah.
Very fine. I get them. I'm like, I don't see any flaws in them at all. I would call them near mint, but they're saying that
Yeah.
they're all very fine.
Yeah,
So
so
I totally agree.
I love their grading. A matter of fact, nobody that I know grades like them. Like Mile High even had their own grading system, and I was never happy with it. So that's my like go-to, like as far as like if I want a good quality book.
Yeah.
I trust them as far as when they tell me something's fine, I know I'm going to get fine or better. If I get something VG, I know it's going to be VG or better.
Well, you know that I took a chance on eBay for the Brave and the Bold, and I have to say, like I did well. I mean, it was it, they said fine, they said fine, very fine, minus, and I got this back, and yeah, I mean it's a good looking book. You
Yeah.
just never,
We should
you can never tell.
compare books 'cause mine is listed as fine minus at a 5.5. And when I looked at your picture, I was like, "Damn, it's pretty freaking close to yours."
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I was really happy with that one. I bought a whole boatload of books, but I don't keep focus like you do, Rob. Rob, you buy like important stuff. I want to buy important stuff, but I just see like an advertisement for Mr. T, and then I like I gotta have that. I mean, I read comics like I read them as a kid, and I see a
Yeah.
little star or like a little editor's note, and I'm like, you know what? That sounds interesting, and I'm down a rabbit hole, and I don't care. I vector. I can't
Yeah.
keep focus at all. I mean, I keep some focus. Like, I've been doing a lot of DC War books, but it's not as controlled as it should be. Like, I would finish things a lot faster if I just stayed focused.
Well, yeah, I've been kind of going, I've been alternating between buying, you know, something that's a little bit more like a bigger book, like this one, the Metamorpho one, and then like I'll place an order on mycomicshop.com for, you know, just filling a bunch of holes for like Legionnaires or
isn't the database like deadly for that though?
Oh, it's, yeah, like, as I'm looking, I'm like, just, oh my God, I'm only missing like six issues.
I swear to God, I just start playing in the database and I'm like, holy crap, I need to have this. And
yeah.
And then I just go down a rabbit hole.
I'm like, oh, why don't I have all of the Legionnaires? Let me finish that. And then I'll go back and I'll like read like the whole series. Cause I started at 0 hour or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, I don't need that much in the first place. Let me see what I can find. So, and then it's frustrating when I can't find, like, when I only need like two or three books left and I just can't find them.
Yeah, there's one that, there's one that's haunting me, and I know it sounds stupid, but there's this book from Atlas, and it's like the only Atlas book I have left to complete the Dead Universe. It's Gothic Romances, and I found two of them, but one was for like 1,020, and the other one was like in VG for $500.
Oh my lord. And then
I found like the print run. They don't even list the print one. It said it could be anywhere from 20 to 100 known copies in existence.
Of so Gothic like, Romances. That's
yeah,
crazy.
I'm like, oh my God, I probably will never get this thing.
Because and then you look in the database, you know, and it says that it's worth $4.
Yeah.
But you can't find it anywhere.
Well, go look on eBay. It's crazy.
Oh my God.
And my comic shop hasn't ever had it, so I've had it in there queued up for quite some time.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, 1974. It has a Neil Adams cover.
Is it a magazine or a comic book size?
It's a magazine, but it's it looks like it. It's magazine sized, but it's comic book material.
Yeah.
It's got like Neil Adams, Howard Chaykin, Russ Heath artwork, Ernie Colone. So it's got some big artists. I love romance comics because they just, I don't know, they just have so much history in them.
Wow. Yeah, $500 or over 1,000.
Yeah. And I've been looking like crazy because I would settle, at this point, I would settle for a G.
Just so you could have it.
Just so I could have it, yeah. Something that's sort of affordable. Because it's, I mean, when I want to complete a Dead Universe, I want to complete it. I don't give a shit what the book is. And I want this. Plus, I like romance books. And you throw Gothic in there, and that's even better. I mean, yeah. If you throw horror and romance together, that's my thing right there. Mixing that's two cool. genres that I really like.
Yeah.
But I almost completed Marvel 2-in-1. I have good. Only the first one to go.
Really?
Everything else is intact and archived.
Well, you got to find that.
The next one is Marvel. Well, that one's not hard to find. It's not cheap, but it's not ridiculous like the first Wally West.
I don't know anyone that would spend money on that. Do you? My God.
I do. I know somebody.
Yeah. You know somebody.
But that's no different than me, really. It's just that you're getting one and I'm getting 100. That's the only difference.
Chris, I pulled the trigger on Flash number 110.
Wow.
Yeah. It's great fine. Is very good. Yeah, it's very good. Fine. It was fine. A slash. Yep. Yeah, it looks real nice. So they haven't said that they've shipped it yet, but that'll be coming probably sometime next week.
I'm pretty sure you inspected it pretty good, at least with the photo.
I did, and then they sent me
because
the
you're a little more anal than me, so you're looking for like certain things.
Yeah, and they sent me the picture of the back cover too, because I sent them an email. Yeah. So it looks pretty good. I'm happy. You know, I was telling Mike, Chris, is that, you know, like, similar to yourself too. I know that I think all three of us are. I mean, I know we're all Flash fans, but Wally West in particular, I'm like, if I could get one that's relatively affordable, I'm like, it's his first appearance. It's like my favorite character. So I finally went ahead and did it.
Well, that's why you're a little smarter than me, because in theory, stuff like that will only go up.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you never know. He'll probably never show up again.
If you look at some of the stuff I'm buying, it'll always be $2. Like, it'll never go higher unless I cause a demand for it.
Yeah. or
buy
Gotham
up all
romances,
the remaining
which,
copies.
Which nobody can find. Do you check Comic Link and stuff for that?
I do, but.
God, the problem with that is they're all graded.
I hate graded books, and I have a love-hate relationship. Matter of fact, I have the first appearance of Black Tom here sitting on the table right next to me. I'm waiting for Barb to heal enough because she's good at cracking these things open, and I'm not. So I'm just going to let her rip it apart. She loves to do it.
How does she get that? Like, I opened up one, and I was, like, scared to death to do it. I thought I was going to, like, do something to the comic book.
She's a master. She sees all these comics on the table, and she takes it out on that plastic like it's nobody's business.
Makes me nervous.
Yeah. She's been real careful. So I'm going to let her rip that sucker open. As soon as she heals up well enough to be careful.
So Mike, I just went on. There's a site, I don't know if you're familiar, Heritage Comics. They do auctions. They're an auction house too. So I went on there just to look, because you can look at all these past sales for Gothic romances.
I
literally see, from what I can see, I only see three times that any of them were up for sale.
Yeah.
One was in 2016. It was a 9.6. Went for $956.
Yeah.
This is 2 years ago. And then the other, there was one in 2017. It was a fine 6.5 for $131.
What year was that?
That was 2017.
Okay, see, that is exactly what I want right there. That price, right. I would pull the gun. $100 for a six? I would even do it at a five. So if any listeners can get me this book for, you know, a couple $100 and it's fine or VG, I'll pull the trigger. I'll tell you right now.
Other than those two, the only other one that they had was back from 2010. Again, it was graded 8.5, but again, that was... Look, you know, like 9 years ago at this point, went for $239, but that was 9 years ago.
Yeah,
that's it.
Well, I think in the Overstreet, I haven't looked in the Overstreet guide to see what it was. I'd have to dig it out, but I wonder if it's listed as scarce, and that's what sort of drives the cost, just because there's enough demand, because there are groups called Atlas Seaboard or whatever they were called. I mean, there are fans of this. I follow them on Facebook. There are people that read Atlas is. I mean, they had good talent. Let's not joke around, man. When they came out, they would have succeeded if Marvel and if the big boys didn't sort of bully them out of the market, because they knew they could take the market via talent. Like, they were taking people away from the big two.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they just couldn't get their foothold in the newsstand at the time, so they couldn't get space, and they struggled. But and the guy had experience because he worked for Marvel, so they were just bad timing. I think if they would have hit at the right time and maybe during the comic book time where it was direct distribution, mm-hmm. maybe they would have done better that way.
Yeah.
It lasted more than a year and a half.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, I'm going to keep my eye out for this stuff too, and I will let you know if I see one.
Yeah, it's one of those universes that I want to complete. And now I'm going down, and I was like, just the other day, I made the big mistake. Okay, I was like, I tweeted out this. I couldn't remember the other catalog. I knew there was Diamond Previews, and I knew the other one was Capital City Distribution. I couldn't remember the catalog name. And luckily, my friend Kirk said, it's Advanced Comics. And then I was like, okay, man, I need to get some of these. So I went on eBay, and I bought two copies of Advanced Comics. And it was cool because they were sealed, and they still had all the card prototypes in them. Mm-hmm. Like they used to always be shipped with cards, and then the trading card flyers and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then I was just going down there and seeing, like, all the different publishers that were publishing comics at the time. And I was like, oh, Triumphant, I remember these guys. And then I started going to my database, and I was like, oh, I have this hole and this hole and this hole. And I'm like, I got to fix that. I need to have this full universe. And, you know, I started looking at Now Comics because of Mr. T. And Mr. T, man, oh my God, is that fun. I mean, it is ridiculous. But at the same time, like, I can emotionally appreciate, like, Mr. T, like, what he was trying to do, anti-drugs and all this stuff. And I freaking remember as a kid seeing him on the Home Shopping Club selling his comic. And I'm like, that's really? Pretty freaking crazy. And I was like, okay, I don't know why I got into it. I was actually going through Facebook photos. And I saw a picture of me with a cosplayer that does Mr. T in Baltimore. And he looks like exactly like him. And I was like, you know what? I don't have Mr. T comics. I got to have Mr. T comics. And if you think about it, you had Neil Adams doing it with Norm Breyfogel. And I forget what the other guy's name, Tony DeZunga. He was like a Western. He used to draw Westerns.
Yeah.
And all these like fantastic artists. And I'm like, I need to have this. And I wasn't disappointed, man. I wasn't disappointed. And then I see the ads. Here's where the rabbit hole shit comes in. I see the ads for other Now comics, and I'm like, ooh, Siphons. This looks awesome. This looks like 90s goodness. And so I put those on my cart. Yeah, And I want to finish my Married with Children, and yet again, there's one rare one that was supposed to publish three issues, and they only published one, and because it went under. And you know those magazines that just have, like, right before a comic book company goes under, they have, like, a really small print run, and they're just expensive.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, crap, there's one of those hard-to-find books.
Is that Lotto Fever?
I think that's it.
Says it's $155, and number two and three were never published.
Yeah, never published. And when Now Comics was coming out, that's all I got from them was Married with Children. Like, I have the first two volumes of it, except for I'm missing a few. But I have some Green Hornet, and the Green Hornets are fantastic. But they did, like, with Dynamite did at the time, where they had published like five different Green Hornet titles, and I would just stick with one. So I want to finish my Green Hornet, and then there's other titles in there that are just really strange that I want to try, like Ralph Snart and all kinds of stuff.
Sounds like you've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And these old distribution catalogs are like, they're gems, man. I could spend hours in there. There are just so many. The 90s, I mean, people might shit on the 90s, but man, it was like blossoming. It was like experimentation. It was companies coming out left and right trying to cash in. And it's the growth of it was just amazing. It was a good time for comics. I hate when people crap on the 90s. I really
well,
do.
I don't think necessarily it was all that different from, like, I don't mean, I agree with what you said, but, I mean, there's good and bad with every decade. You know what I mean? It's like there was a lot of good stuff, and there was stuff that maybe wasn't so good. But, you know, that's no different than other decades.
Half the people,
you know?
Half the people that complain it didn't even, like, have a good sampling to make the judgment call. And it drives me fucking nuts. It really does. I hate when that I hear that statement, like a blanket statement.
Yeah.
Yeah, it drives me nuts because you're right. Every decade has its gems. But the 90s was, like, special because it just, like, what it was doing for the indie world was.
Yeah, it exploded.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think maybe that people saw more of that and pick and choose the stuff that they personally thought didn't work as well. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's, you know, you can point to any decade and just pick two or three or 10 series and say, oh, this wasn't all that good during the decade. But you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that was good. So.
Yeah, I haven't found stuff that's bad, though. Like, I'm sorry, but it's like, I could find a gold nugget in every comic, I think. Even mm-hmm. the ones I don't like. There's something. Whether it be an ad, whether it be the cover art, or the colors, mm-hmm. or something, there's just some gem that makes it worthwhile.
Sure.
And I just love physical media. God, I just love it. I mean, there's something it does for me. I'm even so dumb as Hulu's got me watching commercials again because you have to watch commercials. And now I find I'm not fast forwarding during commercials on the DVR. And I'm listening to radio, like regular radio instead of Sirius radio. I'm like, I don't know, man. I appreciate where I came from.
That's funny.
Longing for that retro experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes me feel young.
I got a question for you, Mike, in terms of we're talking about retro. Think about when you were a child and it was your birthday, okay? I just recently realized, and Chris, you can probably I'm assuming you have the same experience as me because the same area, but I recently realized that there's a lot of local, like, things in the area that aren't just like food related but other types of things. So, like, when you were a kid, maybe you had your birthday party with, you know, a bunch of friends and stuff. After, when they were singing the happy birthday song to you, did they go into another chorus of "What's your girlfriend's first name"?
No.
Have you ever heard of that in your entire life?
Never.
Chris?
Yeah.
It's just Western New York.
It
blows my mind. It blows my mind that like this isn't. So I just thought it was everywhere. It's
yeah. So did
here.
I.
Yeah, it's only here. So, really, like, you know, you'd speak, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. And then, what's your girlfriend's first name? And, you know, you're 12, you just sit there and get embarrassed and stuff like that. Yeah, it's only in Western New York. I can't believe it. I have a woman that I work with grew up in central Pennsylvania. She moved up here. She's like, what in the world are these extra verses? Like, this is so strange.
Well,
like,
I know what I want for my birthday now. I want you guys to call me and add that extra lyric.
We will. You know, there's a lot of. Did you guys have any other, like, verses that you would sing?
No, the only thing to add on was "and many more," but that's
"and many more." Sure,
that's a more common thing.
So you never did "how old are you?"
No.
No. My grandparents used to.
I know that one too.
Yeah, it would last. I mean, the song would last forever because then my grandparents, my good old fashioned Polish grandparents, would sing "May the Dear Lord Bless You" too to that same tune. And "May you live long with us." So we were there like for 20 minutes singing that song.
those ones I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's just I think that was just an old time, like, you know, Polish grandparents thing. But yeah, "What's your girlfriend's first name?" blew my mind when nobody else except for Western New York.
What was it trying to do? Like, you could be young and they were saying that?
Yeah, it's just embarrassing. Just embarrassing the birthday.
Yeah, just embarrassment. Yeah.
Like, when did they start singing this? When you're two? Where's your girlfriend's first name?
No, like, probably, you know, you're probably 8 or 9 or something, and all your friends start singing that, and you turn all red. Yeah.
It's the school of Hard Knocks up here. You don't mess around.
That's right.
They want you to breed early.
We start making...
Oh, you know what? It's your birthday. You think you're such a big shot? Well, how about this verse?
It's your birthday. Go get laid. Yeah. What's your birthday? Yeah. What's your girlfriend's name?
Toughen up your skin so you can handle the cold weather. And
what's your girlfriend's name? Here's your box of condoms to protect yourself.
All right, this year we're gonna get on a conference call. We're gonna sing to you, Mike.
That'll be good.
All right. All right, that's I just wanted to check.
That's an unusual thing, but I'm sure there's a lot more that separates New Mexicans from New York people.
It's like everywhere. It's very strange. How about peanut donuts? Do you have peanut donuts there?
Peanut donuts, like a donut flavored peanut?
So you have a donut.
Yeah.
And you put glaze on it, or the store puts glaze around it,
yeah,
and that rolls it in crushed peanuts.
No, well, no, oh, no, they have that. They've had
really?
That, like it, yeah.
Oh, okay, most other places said no, they don't have peanuts, peanut donuts.
Well, they have donuts that have the nuts on them. I don't know if they're like glazed, and then the nuts stick to the glaze. But I've seen those. I just never have been drawn to them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I heard that was just around here, too. So maybe not.
No, I've always stuck to the plain donuts. Like, I like glazed donuts, and I like chocolate donuts, and I like Boston cream. And when you go outside of that realm, although the other day I had a craving for that big-ass donut that you showed me. I was like, I want one of those. I don't know. I was sicker in hell, and I was like, why do I want a craving for this big-ass donut that Rob was talking about?
To me, there's no such thing as a bad donut. I would have any type of donut.
I don't like Hertz donuts, man. They make me hurt. They're just so dense. They're so dense that I can't handle it.
I don't like Hertz donuts because I don't like getting punched.
Yeah, it hurts.
I've never heard of Hertz.
I think Hertz is a Texas.
You get it free with a west of Texas car rental or something?
Oh, is that what it is?
Spelled like Hertz.
Like the food you find under the seat in your rental car is not an intended bonus.
I would like an Avis donut better.
Yes, yes, that's right. Or Enterprise.
Yeah, Enterprise donuts shaped like a starship.
Mm-hmm. Going all out. All right, that's all I got.
All right, well, this has been Geek Bunch Retrocast.
We're not done. Are we done?
Oh, you said that was all you had. I'm sorry. All you had for regional inquiries.
Well, yeah. We got questions, right? You want to start with that?
Yeah, sure.
Let's some questions. I don't know that I'm going to know the answers to all these questions, but let's see what we got.
Nick thought I was asking for questions. I was just teasing him. He gave me questions well, anyways. So.
I'll take questions. I like getting questions though. It's fun to
yeah, it's good.
About some other kidding. Stuff. Yeah. All right, Mike.
I like the way you move.
I know there's one that I have to actually Google because I don't know who the person is, but I know I'll know some of their movies.
You mean Terry?
I think so.
Terry Gilliam?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll know their movies.
I just, like, Nick has a gift for remembering, like, an artist and a colorist on a book and
yeah.
a director. And for the most part, like, unless it's something that I have some kind of emotional hardcore attachment on a comic book, I won't even remember who did it. if it's a movie, it's even less likely. Like,
I'm actually better with movies than I am with the comic books.
Oh, I'm
like,
horrible.
I tend to know who's writing them, but I couldn't tell you a lot of times who did any of the other work, including the artist.
Yeah.
Mike, do you want me to read the questions?
Yeah, because I want to bring up IMDb and find out who this guy is.
Well, the first one he sent was, did anyone know or watch Sable?
I wasn't aware it was a TV show.
And he's talking about Mike Grell. It's a Mike Grell creation. I think I've talked about the comic on Retro before.
Mm-hmm, you have.
I know I've read at least read some issues of it. But yeah, I guess Nick was reading Mike Grell, Life is Drawing Without an Eraser, a book about Grell's career and stuff, and talks about that there was a Sable TV show. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I had no idea. Did you?
No. Nope.
I did. Because it had Gene Simmons in it. I mean, there's a lot of story that goes on. If you ever go to a Mike Grell panel, he'll talk about it.
Yeah.
I knew about it when I went to Denver Comic Con, I don't know, about 6 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And we went to a Mike Grell panel, and he had a big old discussion about, you know, he thought he was finally selling an IP, and it turned out to be a disaster. Hmm. And Gene Simmons, like, wanted to be in it, and he wanted to be the lead character. And he's like, that ain't John Sable. Because you got to remember who he is. I mean, John Sable's like a guy that is a freelance guy that does detective work, and he's also a kids author, right? He writes
right.
books of leprechauns and stuff like that. I mean, I just can't see him.
Gene Simmons?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't either.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. That's an interesting one.
And then related to that, he asked about our top five Mike Grell titles and no honorable mentions. I mean, I don't think I can even get to five.
No, I can't get to five.
I have never really read much of Warlord. The only things I've ever read, and I like all of them, but are Sable, Star Slayer, and some of both of those, and then some of his Green Arrow run. Mm-hmm. Those are the only things I know of him, and I definitely like all of that stuff a lot. So I think of him as a creator that I like, but that's about it for me.
Yeah, for me, I think I really, sad to say, but because I know that Nick is a big fan, but I think that I can only give two answers, and the first one would be Warlord. I'm really big fan of Warlord, and then the second one is that, you know, Green Arrow with the Longbow Hunters, and then going into the series that Grell did. That's pretty much it for me. Is those two?
I would do my top five. My top five Mike Grell pieces of work. At number one is Warlord, by far. Number two is his work on Green Arrow. He did so much. He did the Longbow Hunters. He did the ongoing up to 100. I mean, it was a long run. Number three would be Sable. Number four would be the one that you mentioned, Star. What do you call it?
Star Slayer.
Star Slayer. Mm-hmm. And number five would be his work on Legion of Superheroes. So those are my top five Mike Grell items.
At least somebody's following the rules. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, well, we tried to, but
yeah,
just couldn't get it up high enough.
Nope.
And then, not so much a question, but just interested in hearing thoughts about John Byrne's Fantastic Four run.
Well, I'll go. Can I go first on this one?
Please.
Yeah, you go for it.
I'll say he was kind of my gateway drug into like buying like ongoing, like a series that I need to get every month. So like, and it's also the first time I recognized a name. Like I knew John Byrne when Fantastic Four was coming out and I was getting it off the spinner rack. And it was my favorite run on Fantastic Four until I read Hickman's run and what was the other? Tom DeFalco run. So Tom DeFalco run I read very late in life. Hickman run I read when it came out. But those are my favorite runs, but I would say in third place is his. And he had a great run, and he in all fairness, he wrote and drew it. So it was even a little more special. And then he had era when he had She-Hulk in there and all that good stuff. I mean, he did a lot with Galactus. I mean, his story with Galactus is probably my most memorable Galactus story in history, where you have the cover. They made a statue of it. You have the cover of Galactus on the whole picture, and then you have the little figures of the Fantastic Four attacking Galactus. I love that cover. And I think there's like Spider-Man and all the other characters attacking as well.
Well, I'll jump in real quick and just say that for me, I agree with you, Mike, that Hickman's run was something special, but my favorite run still is the John Byrne run of Fantastic Four. I came into it late. I got a handful of issues when I could find them in the 260s, at the convenience stores, at the drugstores, and then started to get it straight through probably about 268 up. And it was probably about 10, 15 years ago, I went backwards and got all, from the beginning of John Byrne's run when he wrote and drew it, because he was drawing it for a while with Marv Wolfman as well, but starting to get straight through when he took over with everything. I think it was 232. So I got all those, about 30 issues that I had been missing from eBay, and just read straight through from the beginning to the end. And it's just, he says he's got the omnibus, but he hasn't read any of it yet. Nick, I don't know what you're reading now, but you got to finish up and start reading the Fantastic Four omnibus with John Byrne, because it was absolutely incredible. Fantastic Four has never been probably one of my favorite books normally, but that, like you said, Mike, in terms of constantly being excited for it, I love that run. It's fantastic.
Yeah, for me, when I started reading comics, John Byrne was a DC guy, and then I encountered his work in Avengers West Coast and Sensational She-Hulk. But, and then when I really got to know him as a creator is when I went back and read his X-Men stuff. And to this day, I've read some sporadic, an issue here or there maybe, but I still am not that familiar with this Fantastic Four run, actually.
Well, you got to read that one too.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, that's coming.
Go look at cover 243. That's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of his covers.
That's the one that I just. This is.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a classic.
Yeah, this is the issue that I picked up off the spinner rack, and then I had to seek out everything beyond that. Mm-hmm. It got me hooked. That was the issue.
Well, speaking of artists who not as familiar with their Marvel work, George Perez, another request to discuss his work at Marvel on Fantastic Four and Avengers. And I can answer that again really quickly. I don't think I've ever read the issues of Fantastic Four that he's done, and I don't think I've read his Avengers stuff either, at least the early stuff. I was reading Avengers when he came back on it and was working with Kurt Busiek, and I really liked that because it was kind of a throwback style and stuff. But Perez for me is one of my favorites, but it's because of New Teen Titans, Crisis, Wonder Woman, like, you know, his DC stuff.
A lot of DC, yeah. I never when I saw that question from Nick, I actually was surprised that he mentioned Fantastic Four, and going through and looking, I see that Perez did Fantastic Four issues, but I mean, he never had a substantial run on Fantastic Four. It looks like the mm-hmm. longest he did was like 184 to 188, which is only 5 issues. Now he did some prior to that, 3 or 4 in a row. Prior to that, again, 3 or 4 in a row. Prior to even that one, but that's about it. So I don't think of him when I think of Fantastic Four. I don't think of George Perez at all. However, Avengers, I definitely do. That was one of the ones that I probably wasn't getting off the newsstand, at least that initial first volume. That was slightly before I started buying stuff. But I saw that a lot then, going back and getting older stuff as a kid. And his name was, he's kind of like the first person who I recognized in terms of the being an artist that I loved. Like, oh my God, who's it? And just seeing his name over and over again, like, yeah, I love this guy's work. So, you know, he did a lot of Avengers. In the first volume, but then of course when they did another one with was it Kurt Busiek?
Yeah.
Didn't he come on with him?
Yeah, that's the one Chris mm-hmm. was talking about.
Yeah, so that one obviously, you know, they started a new
that's
number one.
That's when he drew
Avengers.
Scarlet Witch like a real gypsy.
yeah, that's right. And you know, he lasted for quite a while, a couple of years doing that. So, yeah, I love his Avengers work.
I think I own every work from him, everything after Byrne did Fantastic Four. So once I realized there was an artist called George Perez, when I started realizing there were people behind these books, mm-hmm. they didn't just magically appear. then I think I have everything beyond that. Like, I don't have his early Fantastic Four stuff, but well, I do. I do and I don't. How could I say this? I have it in some form of Omnibus or Epic Collection, but I don't have the original issues of his Fantastic Four. But my first exposure to him and getting stuff off the shelf was his Justice League. It was the DC
Yeah,
stuff.
You know what? I think I agree with you, is that first volume of Justice League, that was some great stuff.
But I'll be honest, up until John Byrne's Fantastic Four, I sort of didn't give two shits about the Marvel Universe.
Oh.
I didn't care. I really didn't. And then when I discovered John Byrne's Fantastic Four, I discovered Mark Grenwald's Captain America. I discovered Bob Layton's Iron Man. David Michelinie on Amazing Spider-Man. So that was my gateway drug, was John Byrne getting me into the Marvel Universe. Maybe if that never hooked me, I would have just stayed on the DC side. But, yeah, he's definitely somebody that I'm glad that he's retiring and he's saying, hey, I'm sort of healthy and I'm retiring on his own terms.
He's secure. He's financially secure, which is not a common thing for people in comic books.
No, it's not. But I'm sure he was around enough and had enough name recognition. I mean, he probably could have been even blown up even bigger if he would have somehow gotten to that Image cash cow early on. Like if Liefeld said, hey, I really need you here, bang, he would have had his Porsche and sold 10 million copies.
I'll say
he is one of the nicest guys you can meet at a convention. Like, he doesn't treat anybody bad. He always treats you with a smile. He doesn't feel inconvenienced to talk to you. I mean, my favorite experience with George Perez was when Keith Knutson went up and asked for his Don Quixote sketch. Because who in the world is going to ask George Perez for a Don Quixote? And it was a very interesting conversation because, George Perez's eyes lit up. Like, he's Don Quixote. He's like, I play him in this play. And he's like, I love Don Quixote. And it was an amazing experience to see because, you know, Keith was happy and he asked for something that he really wanted. And he got George Perez to, like, say, wow, you're going to have me draw Don Quixote?
That's really cool. And, Mike, I think that you heard us talk last time that George Perez is coming to the Niagara Falls Comic Con.
Yeah.
So I can't even say how excited I am that he's going to be there.
Yeah, it's a good time to shake his hand and say thank you.
Even like today, after all these years, he is my all-time favorite artist.
Yeah.
I really love him.
For me, it's Kirby, but...
Well, that's a good segue into the next question, which is our top five bronze. He says top five bronze artists. So I'm assuming he means Bronze Age artists, not artists that are made out of bronze or artists that work in bronze metal.
Or artists that literally are bronze color because of their tan.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. See, this is not a great question for me.
Well, for me, when did the Bronze Age end? Because according to some people, it goes pretty long.
Mm-hmm.
It almost goes to like 90-something.
No, I don't. I think that that's wrong.
I would say that it goes up to 86 with like Watchmen and
Dark. Yeah, it goes up to like Crisis and Watchmen, Dark Knight. Like that's an obvious. I think it's an obvious.
But when does it start? In the '70s at some point.
Yeah, the '70s. I would say.
Someone say around the drug issues of Spider-Man and the drug issues of Green Arrow and Green Lantern.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And the Marvel monsters.
Yeah, Marvel Monsters, of course.
Well, John Byrne's one of them. So that's an easy one for me.
It's funny because they kind of like, I don't think of them as like Bronze Age, but they, I guess, they are. But that just shows how
old I am. Well, and some of them overlap and continue to do, like John Byrne, continue to do pretty significant work in the late 80s. Early 90s, but I would say as long as they did some work in the 70s that they're known for, would count. I'll go with, I don't know, I'll try to do this in order, but it's not a, like a set in stone, but, I'll go with 5, Walt Simonson, 4, actually it's hard to put them in order, but 4, I'll go with John Byrne. Like I said, I mean, I'm not super familiar with his Fantastic Four, but his Uncanny X-Men work is among my favorites. 3, I'll go with Frank Miller for Daredevil. And then 2 and 1 is kind of tough for me because it's like, I love them both for different reasons, but obviously we were just talking about George Perez. So it's kind of a tie because he's done some of my favorite, he's maybe my favorite artist or definitely right up there. And I love New Teen Titans so much. I love Crisis and I love his Wonder Woman. And but also Jack Kirby, because for me, Jack Kirby, as much as I appreciate his work in the 60s and earlier, and I love some of the characters that he created during that time period, the work that really wows me and just like I can't even get my head around how amazing it is his work for DC in the 70s.
Oh yeah, his Fourth World is the best.
Yeah, so there's my attempt.
Mine is easy because it follows yours. Jack Kirby is number one. There is no artist that could ever compete with Jack Kirby. I mean, let's be honest. In terms of his creation and his output, like, nobody has that work ethic or can compete with what he was doing. he was a machine. I mean,
did he ever sleep?
He was at his drawing table all the time. I mean, and it was all coming out of his mind. I mean, mm-hmm. Everything that you look at is Jack Kirby.
He's drawing all of the comics.
Jack Kirby is number one. I mean, nobody's even close in my book. John Byrne, for the whole reason that I had to have everything that he did. I mean, I thought he was amazing. Even when he went to like Dark Horse and did X-Men, I had to have John Byrne. I loved his art. Matter of fact, there's some guy aping his style in Red Anvil comics right now, and I get that because it looks exactly like John Byrne art, and it's good to see that somebody can ape him. I've seen people try to ape Kirby, and do a good job, but I haven't seen too many do like John Byrne really good, and this guy does. The other one I'd say is Mike Grell for Warlord. That was in the 70s. And he did Legion then. He's pretty fantastic. And for me, Mike Grell is the best artist that I like to talk to. Like, I feel comfortable talking to him. I love his stories. I have 4 commissions from Mike Grell. I dig his stuff a lot. Then George Perez and John Buscema is next in my list. So that wraps up my top 5.
All right, I did put I got a top 5 together. So I think I would say Gene Colan. I liked a lot of his stuff.
Oh, that's a good one.
A lot of his horror stuff is great. Very atmospheric. Of course, just like you said, Jack Kirby, you know, right from the golden age on up, he's doing great work. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that he did in the Bronze Age, both, you know, the stuff at DC, and also when he came back and wrote and drew Captain America as well. Another one for me is Neil Adams' Batman.
He's Daniel a good Gill. One.
That was some fantastic stuff.
I feel intimidated by him though. I don't know why. I mean, it's because when he has that big ass table and charges you, you know, for a sketch, I mean, or signature and stuff. I'm like, I don't feel he's approachable.
No, like some, you know, of these and other guys. I totally agree. And like, I am not interested in necessarily visiting him at a con because it's just, I mean, it's crazy. Everything is just so pricey.
Those guys that you mentioned, though, God, man, it's, I love them. Okay. So it almost makes me think, should I redo my list? But I'm going to stick with my list.
Yeah. Stick with your list.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I got, and a lot of them we all have on the list too. Like, and then John Byrne, yeah, we just spoke about him. And then number one for me is, no surprise, George Perez. So that's my list.
George Perez is the only artist I know that can get away with drawing hundreds of characters in one book,
mm-hmm.
and succeed at it.
Yep.
I mean, he did Crisis, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
So, I mean, good Lord. I mean, it had every character from every publisher that they acquired in that book. He had to draw everybody. And then you think of Avengers JLA, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they put him on these books because not only could he do it, but he did it in a timely manner, which is insane also. It's like he was pretty fast for the detail that he had.
Oh, and he had way more detail than Byrne. Byrne would at least cheat a little bit because he would not draw backgrounds. He'd draw the character in the foreground good, and then there'd be nothing. There'd it'd be all colored pink or something, or yellow in the background.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perez had an attention to detail, probably more than, at least in my eyes, more than any of the other. The strands on Scarlet Witch's hair, oh my God.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, every fine line detailing her hair, and her hair was really long and everything. I mean, he had an attention to detail that a lot of these other artists, I mean, each artist has a strength, right? I mean, they all have their strength and skill, but his attention to detail is out there. I mean,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's why I think when you talk about, if you talk about anybody that you could maybe say approached the productivity of Kirby,
yeah,
it would be him, I think. And it's also, have you, you've heard how he does his drawing? Like, I mean, the how he physically does it?
I haven't.
That he draws lying down on the couch.
Oh, what? Wow. That's got to be incredibly uncomfortable.
I guess
on his stomach? On his stomach or his belly?
No, on his back. Like, he lies on his back.
What?
His stomach and his belly are the same time. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure about this, that he draws lying on his back.
What is he resting his picture on? Nothing?
I think he either on his legs or he holds it up with one hand and draws with his hand, like his other arm.
No, that's just,
like,
that's just insane.
Around.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you have me kind of doubting myself.
The only other crazy way somebody draws is if you ever seen Eric Larson draw.
At least he's sitting.
No, but have you ever seen how he grips a pencil?
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea how he doesn't
look
get
like
major,
humanly possible
like,
to be
like
able to.
Nerve damage in his arm, in his hand, I mean.
He would make my list, but I consider him out of the Bronze Age.
Oh, yeah, he's not. Yeah. He's not Bronze Age.
But he is one of my favorite artists. It would be interesting to take this to the next decade. You know, the next age and see what, I mean, not now, but maybe for a future show.
Yeah. Maybe if anybody out there can confirm for me and
about the belly
that I
are laying on,
that, yeah, about
on
laying
his
on his back on couch. Cause I'm not sure. Maybe I just dreamt that or something.
You just have these sweet dreams of George Perez laying on his back drawing for you.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Feed them some grapes and keep them nourished.
That's right.
Oh, boy. Is that it? We got more questions?
The last one was top three Terry Gilliam films.
That's easy. Good. Can I go?
I actually have that.
Could I go first?
Go.
Sure.
I only care for one of them, and that's Time Bandits. So my only answer is Time Bandits.
Have you seen other ones though that you just don't like?
I've seen parts of Monty Python, and I just can't watch it. I just don't.
Oh my
like
God!
It.
Come on, Mike.
No, it's not
that
for
makes me.
Me.
So sad.
No.
Just one
is
woman.
That it though? You haven't seen 12 Monkeys or?
I didn't.
You
like
have to have
Monkeys.
Seen 12 Monkeys.
I didn't like 12 Monkeys.
You didn't like it though.
I was
Chris,
looking
do you
at what
answer?
He wrote. Are you looking at directing or what? What are you looking
I'm
at?
I'm just
directing,
looking at
yeah.
directors. Yeah.
Directing.
Okay, directing. Let me see. No, Time Bandits is the only one.
Like you're gonna stick with your answer.
I'm gonna stick with my answer.
I've never seen Time Bandits.
Oh my goodness.
And that was what Aaron Bell on Twitter said was his number one, and then number two was just everything else. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say, these aren't in order because I haven't seen any of them anytime recently, but I am going to say that 12 Monkeys is one of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I find it really watchable. I've seen it multiple times, just happen to catch it on TV, and it's just an easy movie to watch. Going backwards, Fisher King and Brazil. Those are the only other ones I've seen. Fear and Loathing, which I liked. And, of course, I've seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which that has been kind of ruined for me by just so many people being obsessed with it and quoting it and stuff. I just made me, like, I haven't even seen it that many times, so I feel sick of it.
Well, I will tell you that I think I've only seen four of his movies, so doing the top three isn't that hard. My number three would be 12 Monkeys, but you know I liked it very much. Number two is The Fisher King, which I thought was incredible with Robin Williams and Jeff Bridges. And number one, despite what you said, is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which just cracked me up. When I was younger, I haven't seen it recently. The only other one I had seen is Time Bandits. I liked it very much as a kid. I watched it somewhat recently, and it just didn't appreciate it as much as I did when I was younger. So that would be my fourth one instead of in the top three.
That's what I have to say.
I'm sorry.
Matter of fact,
I'm
going to go on Amazon right now and add that to my cart.
You are?
Yeah, if they have it in DVD. Blu-ray. Wow, that's expensive.
Really?
Well, this isn't an authoritative source, I would say, but I found a blog called comicsrecommended.com. A post from several years ago where the writer of the blog says that they once had a George Perez art book and it had a photo of George Perez lying on his couch, head on one of the armrests, left leg up on the couch seat, right leg crossed on top of left to support a wooden board on top of which was paper used by comic illustrators.
That's even more, like, that blows my mind. That, like, he's already, like, drawing the way that he's drawing. I mean, you know, in terms of his style and his detail. And then to know that he's drawing like that on his back is just even more impressive.
Well, that answers all our questions. You guys want to get into our whatever our picks are?
Sure. Do you want to start, Mike?
Sure. Well, in one of my orders, well, there's two goals I was having. I was trying to complete all of the Marvel graphic novels. And most of the ones that I knew, I had read The Life and Death of Captain Marvel, or the one I was missing was New Mutants. And it was the first appearance of all these characters and the first appearance of the New Mutants. And from what I understand, it was told, like, it was something that, you know, Chris Claremont was God back in this time period. And Jim Shooter wanted to take advantage of God and tell him, we need more mutants. This stuff is selling. We need more mutants. So he decided to create this New Mutants. And at the time, the part I didn't know, thank God for footnotes, is that the X-Men, Professor X at the time, thought the X-Men were gone. Like, they went into space against the Brood and they were dead or so. And I didn't know that because I've never been an X-Men fan, although it's changing. I'm starting to buy a lot of X-Men. So this takes place when the X-Men were gone and Professor Xavier had nothing. Like, he had no X-Men at home with him. This Harley's going after this squirrel. She's stalking it. And the squirrel doesn't even see Harley. He doesn't care. He knows Harley's not going to do nothing. He's like, what are you going to do? But what this is it's a bunch of mutants. Rain Sinclair is out, and she's being chased by her pastor because she has, like, a Catholic Irish upbringing, kind of mm-hmm. like, you know, Nightcrawler's another guy who's real religious. I always consider him the X-Men priest. But she was being chased by the preacher, and Maura McTaggart was there, and she sort of saw her lying there naked, and she knew who she was, and she decided to save her and says, you know what, you're a mutant, I'm going to take you to be with Professor X. And then it introduces Karma, which I didn't have much exposure to Karma. I don't remember her too much. I remember her being evil and fat because of the Shadow King. Mm-hmm. That's where I remember Karma from, and mm-hmm. her drawn really weird. I guess it was Sinkovich time period. Mm-hmm. And here she looks. This is by the way, Bob McLeod. He was the co-creator. Very different from the Sinkovich style. That I think that's when I started to jump on the book. And she was trying to take care of her brothers and sisters. She was Vietnamese, and Professor X wanted to help her. And then Sunspot was kind of in the middle of a soccer game. And it's interesting how Claremont plays with, like, racial tension and stuff through mutants. But in this case, he was even playing upon interracial relationships, because Sunspot was dating a white girl, and there was a bunch of white soccer players that were offended by this and were beating the crap out of him when he sort of sunspotted out. And Sam was really interesting, because I never realized that, you know, he was trying to go off to college, and his father was a coal miner. He died of a black lung. And because he died, Sam had to go to work at 16 in the coal mines to keep his mother and siblings.
Tell Barb we said bless you.
Oh, yeah. That wasn't her.
Oh. Was I that thought I you? Heard a sneeze.
I heard something, too, but it wasn't her.
Okay. Oh, must, yeah, it was here.
Barb was going out the door. She's getting her hair cut.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. So I knew it wasn't her. So he had to go work in the mines and end up saving his boss using his cannonball powers. That was the first time he was exposed. Who else was there? Oh, Dawnstar, Moonstar. She lost her grandfather, and Her grandfather, before he passed, said, you know, I want to send you to Professor Xavier because you have these abilities. And she's like, I don't want nothing to do with the white man. I don't trust the white man. I don't blame her. But she was fighting nature, and then her grandfather died, and she was bitter. She wanted revenge. She knew that who killed her. And I'm going to get this name wrong because I don't have it with me. But is there a guy named Pierce?
Donald Pierce?
Yeah, Donald Pierce. Thank you. I knew you guys could fill it in for me. Donald Pierce was kind of the main villain in this book. He's the guy that was monitoring these new mutants and wanted to go after him. As a matter of fact, he recruited Cannonball before and used Cannonball to fight the other team as they were coming to fight him. What are those bionic drones that he has? Do you know what I'm talking about? The ones that have no noses and the faceplate?
Are they... I think they're just... Aren't they just part of the Hellfire Club?
Yeah, they're part of the Hellfire Club. But
I think they're just minions.
Yeah, I don't know if they have names other than...
I thought they had some kind of weird name because they were all people that were torn apart by Wolverine at some point.
Oh, okay.
They were all mercenaries or soldiers. And hey, Harley, get off of there. What the fuck are you doing? Hey. She was on the counter.
Trying to get in something?
Yeah, I don't know what she was doing. I've never seen her do that before with me here. I mean, she's obviously done it.
Sorry. Pierce was related to the Reavers.
Reavers, that's it.
But
nobody had something to do with the Hellfire Club at the time because he had captured one of the members and was going after Sebastian Shaw.
Yeah, he was like one of the black whatever, white something of the Hellfire
Club.
Yeah,
he was involved in the Hellfire Club, and he's also the one with the Reavers who were, I think, the guys that were torn apart by Wolverine.
Yes.
Originally.
So those characters, they all kind of wear the same outfit, and they have, a matter of fact, Dani, is that her name? Dani Moonstar? Or
Dani.
Dani. She has the ability to project mirages. That's her code name, right? And she used the fear of Wolverine when they were fighting those bionic things because... He just started, like, this image of Wolverine came out with his claws, and those guys all fell to their knees. Like, they were, like, protecting themselves like they were going to get shredded. And they, like, just totally freaked out. But, yeah, this book was real. It got me, like, excited to read more New Mutants. I might continue on with this. And it is a really cool thing because Professor Xavier... If it wasn't for Maura McTaggart saying, you know, you really need to take these kids because they have no other place to go, Professor Xavier was kind of like in this mode, like, I want nothing to do with kids anymore because I got my kids killed. Like, my kids are dead because of me. I don't want to do this. And because of this little adventure and things where they had to work together, they formed this New Mutants. And it was fascinating because there was another member that Donald Pierce had in this like contraption that was from that organization. I always call them the S&M group, but what were they called?
Club?
The Hellfire Club.
Uh-huh.
To me, they're like this S&M sex group, but I don't know. It's just weird.
You're not wrong.
they dress in those little pirate outfits. I mean, they just look so fucking bizarre. And then all the women are in this like negligees and stuff. There is a woman in here. I don't know if they even named her, but he has her captured, and they help her escape. And she's like in some kind of weird contraption. But if I was able to find it, I would tell you her name because it would probably ring a bell because you guys know more about mutants than I do.
I mean, I think it's been specifically said that that's what the Hellfire Club is based on.
An S&M group?
Yeah, like S&M and that kind of like an underground club.
Oh, and Rain almost died, but her healing abilities allowed her to... It was weird because she was, like, almost dead from her encounter with Pierce. And Professor Xavier was talking to her. He's like, "You have to go pull the lever so I can be free to fight Pierce," because he had his mental abilities blocked. Also, Karma's blocked. She couldn't enter in Pierce. None of them could. And that's why he was sort of fighting them one by one and winning. And Rain did get over there and pull the contraption lever, and that's kind of how he got defeated. But they didn't mention her name. But she was wearing like a Playboy Bunny outfit, and I wanted to know who she was. Oh, man. I see the panel in which she's there, but they don't mention her name. It sucks, because I wanted to know who she was.
I know that there was she was kind of like there was one that was kind of like an assistant. I can't remember her name.
She's like wearing this like bikini with a bow tie. She really does look like a Playboy Bunny. And I like it too at the end. Professor X actually, you know, they come out in these X-Men costumes. He's like coming out and he's like yelling at Dainey. He's like, "You're not wearing protocol," because she's wearing her Native American boots and she has like this jewel-based belt and it doesn't have the X. And she says, "Well, if you don't like it, well, I'll just leave." And I'm like, that's pretty cool. And Professor X like, "Okay, I got to get over my mental retentiveness because I need to keep her here."
No, so it didn't say her name at all, so you wouldn't, if I just said her name, you wouldn't know if it was her or not, right?
She only appears, like, in four panels, and I've kind of scanned the book to see what the, like, if she, she was mentioned. As a matter of fact, she's talking to Professor X, but he never, like, acknowledges her name. Like, I don't know who she is. She has black hair. It's like black short hair. Right? Black hair and short hair. Is
it
Tessa?
I think it might be.
It probably might be. Yeah.
She was kind of like the aide to Shaw, but I know that she had something to do with Donald Pierce as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It is Tessa, because I found it. It says, "Don't fret, Tessa," after Xavier.
Yeah, it sounded like Tessa.
Yeah, it's Tessa. I found the panel finally. It took me a while.
Yeah, she was kind of like a nothing character until years later.
Yeah.
Claremont decided to make her out to somebody, be somebody else.
There are a couple of panels in here by McLeod that are very reminiscent of John Byrne. I mean, I can take screenshots of them, but he draws that Tessa like John Byrne would have drawn her. So this was fascinating. Do you guys own this, or have you read it?
You know, it's funny. I mean, it was a while ago now, but it still seems recent. It wasn't back when it came out. I picked it up probably about 10 years ago or so, and I read it for the first time then. So this is, you know, well after the entire New Mutants run. I'm like, why don't I have this? It's not that expensive. So I bought it and read it at that point, but I haven't read it since. So this is
What a great book for like first appearances though.
Mm-hmm.
It has.
I remember wanting it.
It
at
has
the time,
so many.
But it was too expensive back then.
Yeah. You know,
as a kid, I didn't want to spend the money on.
Well,
that.
There's like a gazillion prints, and I make sure I got the first print.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So
have you read this, Chris?
Yeah, I've read it. I don't own it, but I've read it. The early New Mutants stuff is really good stuff. I'll always be amused by the novelty of it was significant enough that there were new mutants being introduced that they could just call it new mutants.
I never thought of that before, Chris.
You know, just Because I mean, now it's just, you know, eventually it just got so out of hand with the amount of mutants that were being introduced. There's no, like, you know, new mutants, like, you know, it's like, you know, coffee in the morning. There's nothing unusual about it, but at the time it was a big deal that they were going to introduce new mutants, and but doubly significant that the, as Mike talked about, the actual mutants that we were familiar with were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and also keeping a good range of diversity too in their characters.
Yeah, well, you know, he kind of mimicked, you know, the new X-Men.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It kept that same sort of formula.
Mm-hmm.
So props to him. I mean.
Yeah, and you know, just going back to Tessa for a second, she, I don't know if you know, Mike, but she became Sage later on, and you know how.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Sage, so you watched, I know, Gifted, Sage. Right?
I did read Extreme X-Men. Was it
mm-hmm.
Extreme
X-Men? That's her.
Sage was a big character in that. I had no idea. And I watched mm-hmm. The Gifted.
Yeah, so she's in The Gifted.
She's in The Gifted. I had no idea it was the same character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was referring to earlier when I said that, you know, he just kind of had this character that wasn't that significant. But then when he did Extreme X-Men, he made her into something more significant.
Yeah,
this was fun, and a matter of fact, it sparked my interest, and I bought the first appearance of Dazzler, like the first appearance of Black Tom Cassidy. I bought the second appearance of Emma Frost, so like I got some key appearances in the same sort of time frame.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then one of my next, after I finish Marvel 2-in-1, one of my next big procurements from Reed is going to be his X-Men collection. So.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I you know how, what a big fan I am, so it's exciting to me that you're getting into some of these and reading these. And, you know, you kind of alluded to it before when you started talking about the issue, but I had seen some interviews with Chris Claremont, and it's a lot like you said, in that X-Men was blowing up, and he obviously, you know, he took this pretty early on. He, you know, took this group of characters and had 100% control over kind of what was going on with them. They were in their own, you know, universe, and now they're starting to blow up, and Jim Shooter's like, oh, we're going to need another book. And Chris Claremont didn't want anyone else like messing around with that part of the Marvel universe. So he's like, nice. All right, well, I'll write that. And then he's like, well, you know, that really hit something. Now we're going to need another one. And he's like, all right, I'll write that. And he just kept writing. And it was because he didn't want anyone else touching them.
Until he was very possessive.
He was very possessive, yes.
Well, and I think, I mean, they basically ended up having to force him off the books. And he wasn't happy about it either.
No.
That's how he kind of, like, was bitter at Marvel for a while for telling them they're making them move on.
Yeah.
But, well, Rob, you want to go next?
Oh, sure. Okay, so I'm going to cover Brave and the Bold 57 and 58. This is the first and second appearances of Metamorpho. And as I mentioned quickly on Twitter last night, I was, one of the things I was, it was interesting is that every, you know, all these supporting characters, they were fully formed, like right from the first page. Whether it's Simon Stagg, how he acts, and his daughter Sapphire, and Java the caveman, they're like, and it's funny because like I'm reading the Terrifics, you know, nowadays, and even the Metamorpho miniseries that came during the New 52, and it's, I mean, they're exactly the same characters, pretty much. But this was really fun to read. The 57 features his origin and how he becomes Metamorpho. And, you know, he's basically, they call him a soldier of fortune or a mercenary, but I mean, he's an explorer. He's doing a lot of work for Simon Stagg, and he's in love with with Simon's daughter, Sapphire. Basically, Simon is sending Rex Mason, who becomes Metamorpho, around the world to, you know, find different artifacts and you know, things of, like, you know, a historical value or a lot of, like, archaeology. I kind of, like, liken it a lot to, like, Indiana Jones almost. So he's just getting back from finding a head-shrinking formula that Simon asked him to get. And he sees that him and his daughter, Rex and his daughter, went off on their own instead of being picked up at the airport. And, you know, Simon's pretty upset because he knows that that Rex is going to want to propose marriage. And Java's upset, too, because he's in love with Sapphire and is jealous of Rex. And he works for Simon. Simon has no intention of letting Java marry Sapphire either, but he doesn't actually go on to say that. But he brings Rex in and says, listen, I have one more job for you to do. I'm going to pay you $1 million. Why don't you get this Orb of Ra? And Sapphire doesn't want him to go, but Rex says, listen, it's for $1 million. If I do this, we're not going to be dependent on your dad for money or for anything. We can go off and you know, have our own lives. So Simon says that Java's going to go with him. And really what he wants to do is he does want the Orb of Ra, and he wants Rex to get it. But at the same time, he has Java there to kind of trap him and leave him in this place for dead. Turns out that it's in this big pyramid out in the desert. And when Java and Rex both go and find it, Java ends up knocking Rex Mason out. And he ends up finding this glowing meteorite, and he's kind of trapped in this one area of the pyramid with this meteorite, and it's actually glowing and hot, and he passes out. When he comes to, the meteorite is no longer heated up anymore, and he gets up and starts walking around, and he's actually sees a mirror in one of the sarcophaguses. And he sees that he's been changed into what we know as Metamorpho. He's trapped in the pyramid. He can't get out. Java replaced the stone that he had lifted to let them both in. So he's sealed in. And instinctively, he ends up changing into a gas and escapes that way. So he ends up getting onto the plane just before Java takes off. Makes it back to Simon Stagg's headquarters. But what he ends up finding out is that as he gets back there, they're actually on the lookout for him regardless, and they capture him. And what Simon wants at this point is to do, like, experiments and try to get more power from the fact that now Rex is Metamorpho and has all of these strange abilities. So he ends up negotiating with him and says, listen, if you kind of help me out with stuff, then we'll try to get you back to normal. And so towards the end, Rex feels like he doesn't really have a choice. He's still in love with Sapphire, and despite his appearance, Sapphire actually is still in love with him, much to his surprise. And Simon ends up hiding Orb of Ra because he sees that he can actually control Metamorpho with it. And he says, I'm going to hide this. And he's his element, but his, you know, Metamorpho's element state makes him valuable to me. I'm going to, you know, try to string him along. And then that's the end of that first issue. And in 58, we see that Rex is trying to lead a normal life with a disguise with Sapphire, but Java actually exposes him in public that he's, you know, looks like a freak. And Metamorpho's not too happy about that at all, but he tries to make the best of it. He goes onto a special race, and he still doesn't know that Rex Mason, or everyone doesn't know that Rex Mason is Metamorpho, because there wasn't enough people around when he exposed him earlier. And during this race, there's an oil slick that happens, and Rex gets by it, but all the other cars are going to spin out and crash. So he ends up transforming into something called Carbonundum, and he releases that all over the oil and actually makes it abrasive so people don't slip and crash. And this was in front of a huge crowd, so now everyone knows that that he's very strange. So, you know, the next scene shows Rex in with Simon in his office and says, "Listen, just, you know, relax and be a hero." And he said, "All right, fine. That, you know, I'll do that as long as you keep funding, you know, a cure for me." And Simon says, "Yeah, you know, there's no cure, but I'm going to tell him that we'll do that." So that night, there's a masked man that we don't know who it is, and he ends up finding the Orb of Ra, and using that, he knocks out Metamorpho. He drags his body onto a plane and takes him off to Africa. Who it ended up that it was is one of Simon's other associates, one of his minions, I should say, named Karko, who was actually in the first issue as well. And he doesn't understand why Karko took him, except for that if he can control Metamorpho, then perhaps he can get him to do other things and enrich himself. So Java, Sapphire, and Simon go and try to find Metamorpho in Africa. What Karko's whole mission was is that he got Metamorpho for another man whose name is, let me see, it is Tremaine, Maxwell Tremaine. And he paid Karko off to bring Metamorpho to him because he wants to basically examine him. He used to be a scientist during World War II for our side, but became a traitor and started working for the Nazis. And he's been hiding out here since that happened, and has been looking at basically any time that any country doesn't have has a thing that they use for war that doesn't work out the way they want, whether it's some sort of strange tank or a rocket or whatever, any type of weapon, it doesn't work right, they dump in this particular valley. And so they're unaware that this Tremaine is here. And what he does is he grabs these junk weapons, and with his genius, he makes them work. So he basically wants Metamorpho to work for him. Of course, Metamorpho refuses, so they throw him down into this pit of these different weapons, and one by one, Metamorpho kind of has to try to beat them. Like, one looks like this huge daddy long legs, but it's made out of steel, so he oxidizes it into rust. There's another thing that this, it's called a flail tank. It looks like a tank, but it has this huge, like, spiky thing on it that's just, that can destroy anything. And Metamorpho is trying to get out of the way, and the good thing is the flail's actually destroying a lot of the other weapons down there. But he finally, Metamorpho finally turns into sulfur, potassium, carbon, and nitrogen. And when it hits it, hits him, the whole thing blows up, including Metamorpho, but he turns into gas and is able to reconstitute himself eventually. So Tremaine's still not done with him. He's still throwing weapons at him, but he's defeating them one by one until finally Simon and crew get there in the plane, and Tremaine launches one of the weapons at the plane, and it disintegrates the entire plane, leaving the three of them, Java, Simon, and Sapphire, just falling to their supposed death. But of course, Metamorpho, what he does is creates himself into a huge long ladder, grabs Sapphire, and then Java grabs a rung of the ladder and grabs Simon, so they're all saved. It's funny how from the start, and it happens, you know, today, that there's that like hate relationship between Simon and Metamorpho, but they still seem to work together a lot, largely because of Sapphire.
He's an evil bastard.
Yeah, and it's funny that it's just like that, you know, they still like associate with each other because of Sapphire, but you know, they can't stand each other.
She's,
you know,
so naive too.
Yes.
Like she's so naive to her father, like,
and especially she, like before, like a little Rex, less so currently, yeah, but yeah.
Poor Rex has to walk a fine line, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the awful in-law where you know the in-law's pure evil, but you know the daughter will never believe it. Do you know
exactly
what I mean?
Yeah, and you're in
it's
love
like, that's
with this
my,
woman,
that's
so
my
you have
dad.
To just
yeah,
deal
that's
with
my
it.
Dad yeah. You're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So towards the end, the last thing that Tremaine is throwing at this whole group is this this weird-looking like mantis robot creature, and nothing can penetrate this thing's hide. It knocks out Java. Tremaine grabs Sapphire. It's really just Simon and Metamorpho left. So what Metamorpho ends up doing is he turns into a carbon drill, but he ends up spinning and pushing himself against the ground. And through the pressure, he turns himself into a diamond. And sure enough, with the diamond drill, he's able to penetrate the hide of this mantis robot and defeat him. And so from that point on, they're able to rush into Tremaine's secret headquarters. He tries to grab the Orb of Ra to stop Metamorpho, but he turns his hands into a bunch of sand and knocks Tremaine out of the way, punches him, and Simon grabs the Orb of Ra. And then at this point, all four of them wait for a second plane to come on Simon's command, and then they're going back to Simon's house. So even at that point, you see that Rex is still in an odd situation where he's still dependent on Simon, and he thinks that Simon is still going to try to help him cure him from being Metamorpho. So those issues were fun to read. I really enjoyed seeing this, the first appearance of this character.
Cool.
Yep.
All right. I guess that leaves me then.
It does.
I am going to talk about Shazam. Let's see. This is from a celebration of 75 years.
I read that one.
Yeah, it's Shazam, the World's Mightiest Mortal, number 29. so from the 70s series. It's called a DC TV comic because there's a show. And this is called Ibac Meets Aunt Minerva. It's a story by E. Nelson Bridwell with art by Kurt Schaffenberger and Vince Coletta. And it has a kind of cartoony style to the artwork that fits the tone. It's just sort of humorous. And Rob, you said you read this collection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you might remember this story, or you might remember when this actually happened, because it takes place in Buffalo, Niagara Falls, New York.
Yes, I took some screenshots of that when I was, some pictures, I should say, from my phone when I was reading that, because I thought that was interesting, yes.
Yeah, so it starts out with longtime nemesis of Captain Marvel, Thaddeus B. Savanna, and he's got a guy who just looks like a small little man who's a street cleaner, but... Savannah is trying to force him to say his magic word, which is Ibac. And actually, while Savannah is doing this, none other than Prince Lucifer, the one that apparently gave Stanley his Ibac powers, back when he was a two-bit crook called Stinky Print Whistle. Stinky is a great nickname. So they force him to say Ibac, which, like Shazam, is the letters stand for different names. In this case, it's Ivan the Terrible. B is for Borgia. A is for Attila, and C is for Caligula. And so Stanley turns into Ibac, who's like a bare-chested, hairy-chested man. With black pants. Meanwhile, Uncle Marvel in the Marvel Mobile, I guess it's called, he is in Lafayette Square outside of Buffalo City Hall. And it's funny, it looks like, I don't know what the technique at this time would have been, but it doesn't look like they drew Lafayette Square in City Hall. It looks like they kind of copied it from a print or something like that, because it's not in the same like cartoony style as everything else. I don't know, they use some kind of technique to do the backgrounds here, but it makes it recognizable. So there's a guy who's talking to Uncle Marvel. It says he has a job for Captain Marvel, and so Uncle Marvel sends Billy around the corner to say his magic word and come back as Captain Marvel. When he comes back, there's tons of people. Uncle Marvel is sitting on top of the Shazam Mobile so that he doesn't get lost in the crowd, and there's just tons of people that needy Buffalonians asking for favors. And like, please make our sports teams good. Meanwhile, Ibac encounters Aunt Minerva, who is an old lady that's also a criminal. And she likes to like hit on the men around her. Ibac is pretty nervous. That she says, I've been so lonely since the last of my five husbands died. I need a man to take care of me. But then she says, oh, there's a couple flies on your head, and she pulls out a pistol and fires the pistol to get rid of the flies. Savannah wants IBAC to cause a ruckus in Buffalo while he goes up to Niagara Falls to cause with his own plan. He's got a bomb that he's building. He's going to blow up Niagara Falls and flood our homes. So IBAC takes off, chased by Minerva. He starts wrecking shop. He's twisting, knocking over garbage cans and twisting light poles around, and kind of explains why downtown looks the way it does in some spots. He jumps on top of Rob and his wife's car, and they're mm-hmm. running around.
I remember
Rob's
this.
Wife is saying, "Oh, our beautiful car," and Rob's mm-hmm. says, "With 2 years of payments to go, I won't even be able to use it as a trade-in."
Yep, I remember that.
That was a rough time for him.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
For the family.
I had to borrow money from my dad to get a new car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All because of IBAC.
Yep. I told him to put on a shirt.
So, yeah. Get a shirt, buddy. So Captain Marvel's busy with making the bills good. So Uncle Marvel tries to do something on his own. He gets his own Marvel costume out and tries to intimidate IBAC. But the plan doesn't really work, but he doesn't realize it because IBAC goes running around running away because he spots Minerva coming around the corner. So then IBAC is so scared of Minerva, he's just running as fast as he can, and we get to see the peace bridge between the U.S. and Canada as he runs past it. He's heading off to Niagara Falls, and so is Minerva, and so is Uncle Marvel in the Flashmobile. So IBAC gets close to the falls. He runs all the way there, which is actually kind of impressive because it's like a 30 minutes by car. But he's got, you know, the powers of evil.
He's got the stamina of Caligula.
Yeah. And you know, Caligula used that stamina for something other than running between cities. But he finds a barrel, of course, and he's like, it's stuffed full of scientific stuff. Must be some of Savannah's junk. Well, I know where to put it so it won't get lost. And so he takes it all out and he gets inside the barrel. Well, he, of course, dismantled Savannah's bomb. So Savannah kicks the barrel into the Niagara River to send his bomb over the falls. Of course, it's IBAC inside, so IBAC goes over the falls in a barrel, he gets picked up by a couple policemen. Another nut did it. Don't these idiots know it's against the law to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel? Which is true, because you're probably going to die, not survive like IBAC does.
Yeah, you definitely don't want to go over our side of the falls in a barrel.
No, you're basically swan diving into rocks.
Yeah.
Which is not a good thing to do if you value your life. But So IBAC knocks out both the policemen just in time for Minerva to spot him. So IBAC actually wants the help of Uncle Marvel to get away from IBAC. He's like, "You want my help?" He says, because Minerva wants to marry me, I need some advice on how to get out of her clutches. And interestingly, the Shazam-mobile has a way of contacting the various spirits that have lent Shazam his power. So they actually call up Solomon, and ask for his wife on ask for his advice on women, because he has 700 wives, so who would know better?
That guy has experience. You need to consult him when you buy the next $400 comic book, Rob.
Yes. Very true.
So, Solomon quotes some of his proverbs to him, which don't really help I back out that much. But at this point, Captain Marvel is finishing up some of his tasks. He's delivering some elephants to the Buffalo Zoo, which is the last of the things that he needed to do, I guess. And when he shows up and sees that Ibak is standing there next to Captain, or Uncle Marvel, rather, and so he just flies right in, assuming that the worst, and hits him across the face. They start fighting, and their battle causes the ground to shake. So nearby, Minerva thinks that his barrel bomb has gone off. So he shows up just as the battle between Captain Marvel and Ibak is interrupted by Minerva once more. And Ibak finally figures out a way to deal with the situation and says his power word again and turns back into Stanley, who is, as Minerva calls him, a scrawny specimen. So she's not impressed by this transformation and loses interest. And Savannah finds out that it wasn't his bomb. His bomb didn't go off. And that Ibak had put the parts that he took out of it in Savannah's lab. And just as he realizes this, because of all the shaking of the ground that's gone off, his lab explodes with the bomb. And Marvel grabs him by the back of his shirt and grabs Minerva by her scarf and carts the two of them off to jail. So yeah, I mean, even without like the local flavor, it was definitely an entertaining story. I liked the like more comedic aspect of a story.
I remember liking that one. Yeah.
Yeah, because I've never really read anything from this run. I had number one in there as well of the run, but when I flipped ahead and saw that this one took place in Western New York, I thought, well, I got to read this one.
That was 29, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what made them decide to set it in the Buffalo area.
I don't know. Maybe the writer is familiar, or, you know, it was the 70s, so that at that point was only 20 years of population decline as opposed to 40 or 50.
They needed Niagara Falls for the plot device.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a big draw. I wonder where... Well, Schaffenberg was born in Germany. So
yeah, I just looked them both up. Neither one were born or died anywhere around here, but I don't know what happened in the middle.
Yeah, but he went to school and in college and stuff in New York City, and
yeah.
People in the city tend to be aware of, at least vaguely aware, that there's a state attached to it.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that was cool, though. I remember that story. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Is it my turn?
It is.
Ah. Well, let's get into some Mr. T and the T-Force.
We must.
From Now Comics. I bought the Advanced Edition, and it came with a huge poster. It was a huge poster. I could wear it to work. It is awesome.
What did you get? What was it called? An advanced
copy of Mr. T and the T-Force number one. It came with a poster and some cards. And the poster's huge. You could go to my Facebook page and see it. It says, "What are you doing on T-Day, fool? Get some Mr. T comics." And I've always liked Mr. T. I think he came from a bad background and seemed to stay on the straight and narrow, which is interesting for someone like that growing up where he did. And he always has that Mother's Day thing. You know, be good to your mother, fool. I like that video. I watch it every Mother's Day. And I liked him in Rocky. That was my first exposure to him. Rocky 3, Clubber Lang. He's like, "You want a real man? You come to me." He tells Adrian that.
That's right.
Yeah. And, man, that goes back a long ways because I must have been young when that movie came out because I was in recreation. We used to go to these summer recreation things where the parents would drop us off and we'd spend 5 days a week at this recreation center doing activities. Like Monday would be the movies, Tuesday would be something weird, go to the zoo or something like that. Wednesday would be something else. And then they had like a rec room where you could win trophies and competitions and stuff doing tabletop games. So I had pool trophies, I had air hockey trophies and foosball trophies. But I was the best at foosball. And Mr. T. So Mr. T and the T-Force. It starts off. It starts off with him busting up a bunch of dudes that are selling drugs to kids and women, and he starts going on this tangent about, you know, you're bringing this bad drugs to my neighborhood, and he pulls out this weird contraption, and they're like, "Talk to this," and it's like, "Wow, that's a weird looking gun." He said, "That's not a gun. It's a camera. I'm filming you fools so I could turn you into the police." And he takes out these dudes, and after he takes them out and fights with them, he has a huge fight with them. This is definitely like Neil Adams writing too, because it's way off, like Batman Odyssey crazy. Because after he fights with these dudes, he pulls this one guy out of the car, and he's a younger kid, and pulls him out, and he says, he pulls him, takes him to a dumpster, randomly rips up the dumpster, and there's a bag in the dumpster. And he pulls the bag out, and guess what's in the bag? Take an idea what's in the bag. Take a guess.
Cats. Cats.
No.
Chris,
take
what's
one
your
more guess?
Guess.
Gold chains?
No.
Oh, gosh.
He does say precious gold. You know what it is? It's a crack
hamburgers.
Baby. It's a crack
oh,
baby.
Oh, no.
He pulls a crack baby out
that's
of the dumpster.
That's even worse than cats.
And he gives the crack baby to this drug addict. And he says, "You're going to take care of this baby, you fool. Take it to the clinic and do all this stuff." And he does take the baby to the clinic. And and then it goes off like he's forming like this. You know how Doc Savage and Shadow have their agents like throughout the city? That's kind of like what Mr. T's forming. He's forming all these agents without, he has no powers. He's busting up drug people. The other artist that takes over, okay, Neil Adams does issue one and two. I couldn't stop reading. I only tended to read one issue, and I read all, there's 10 issues, and I read five. I couldn't stop. I just had to keep my eyes on this train wreck. I just had to. And I would have read all 10 if I had the rest of the issues. My comicshop.com didn't have 6, 7, 8, and 10. So the next issue I have is 9.
10 is a pricey one, Mike.
I'll buy it, Mr. T. As long as it's not in the gothic romances area. Price point. But, well, those last, I mean,
if you talk to speculators, one thing they never really mention in their own podcast is buying the last issue. If I was to advise on speculation, and I'm not to advise, I know a lot about it. I like to know how comics sell. You should buy the first issue, the second issue, and the last two issues. The last two issues are expensive because the first two issues, they have a larger print run. The last two issues, their print run drops to almost nothing.
Yep.
So, I mean, that would be my advice to speculators on a series is buy the last two issues.
I remember being a younger teenager and I got back into the Star Wars comic books.
Yeah.
Around issue, like in the issue 80 something. And so I started collecting it right through. And that like last issue, oh my God.
Well, doesn't it have like a Jim Lee cover or something like weird? I thought that last issue has something special too.
No. Oh, it's the inker is Will Portasio.
Portasio.
Yeah, okay. but it's just got a super, super low distribution, low print run, very, very low. So it was like everything else is like very low price, and then that one was like $100 or something like that, just because nobody was buying it.
Yeah, that's when it was going down. I've been reading some Star Wars in omnibus format. I don't have much. I have the movie adaptations at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I have some sporadic issues here and there. I have all of the issues on Omnibus, and that's where I've been reading them. It's really good. I mean, I'm surprised. I like that damn Green Rabbit.
From early on, yeah.
Yeah, I dig him, man. He's awesome. It's like, why can't this guy be in the movies?
It was interesting down the road when I started picking it back up, in those later issues, because Return of the Jedi was already out and done, and there was no more. So they actually got a little bit more free with kind of what they were doing with the characters.
Yeah.
Because that was it. They weren't planning on any more movies, you know, at that point. So it was I thought it was interesting, but obviously, you know, interest in demand waned as the last movie got farther and farther, you know, out in the past. So,
and I do want to get these books at some point. I mean, it's definitely in the queue. I've been into like movie, like I just completed the last Starfighter series.
You?
Yeah. I just bought, I mean, a while back I bought Dragon Slayer. So I have Dragon Slayer in single issues and magazine format. I love that movie. I just completed all the Indiana Jones movies that Marvel put out.
Mm-hmm.
They put out through, you know, Temple of... What was the last one? Last Crusade. And I completed Indiana Jones from Marvel. So, yeah, Star Wars has my interest. But anyway, back to Mr. T. He has to break up, like, a car... they're stealing all these cars. Like, well, right now in Colorado, one of our biggest thefts is, like, stealing new cars. Like, they steal them because people leave them running in the cold. It's it's actually a crime to leave your car running now. You can get ticketed if you leave you're warming up your vehicle.
Oh, wow.
The doors aren't locked because there's people that drive near neighborhoods, find the running car, and just hop in there and steal the car. But in this case, there's... stealing all kinds of cars, and there's this guy behind it, and Mr. T has to take him out. And he has some crazy villains. There's this Inca guy. I think he appears in issue 2, and he's got like these guns for arms and stuff. And Mr. T and him are fighting, and Mr. T's like, I gotta take down you drug runners, and you know, you fools are bringing drugs into the neighborhood. And he's like fighting him, and that guy's saying, well, you're killing families, Mr. T. And he's like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, all of my family works in the cocoa fields that provides drugs to you. And you're stopping you're preventing the sale of the drugs, which
Shame
is causing our families to starve to death.
Oh, my Lord.
So there's stuff like that, and it is amazing. But get this, in issue 3 and 4, Norm Breyfogle takes over pencils. So you have Neil Adams and Norm Breyfogle, and that was really awesome. 'Cause I Breyfogle, if we get into that section where we go into the next decade of artists, Breyfogle's there for me. Matter of fact, he's my favorite Batman artist ever. And that's saying a lot, 'cause there's a lot of great ones like Aparo and
Oh my God, yeah.
which he didn't make any of our lists, surprisingly. But
Oh my God, why? Well, I totally forgot about him.
yeah.
I in retrospect, I probably would have taken him over Gene Colan.
So there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
But I am hooked on this T-Force. It ended up on a cliffhanger in issue 5. And I like the trading cards, 'cause the trading cards actually gives you a quote from Mr. T, and then they're like pro stay off of drugs, and like it even has like an advertisement to call their hotline, and you can listen as a kid to Mr. T every week, a different saying, Mr. T, and inspirational. And the let people that wrote in to the letters pages, it's really fascinating, 'cause they're like, there's not too many comic books where the hero won't have a gun in the 90s or won't be killing people, and Mr. T's out there just helping people. And a matter of fact, he owns a rental in this, and there's one older woman, she's in her 60s, she's like 68, and she's always saying, Mr. T, I can't pay you this month, I can't pay you. And that's all right. And he says, but can you fix my toilet? The toilet's been running. So he's up there fixing the toilet. So Mr. T's helping these people. He's helping all these people. He respects all the town. There's the one issue in the cliffhanger that ends that I was really interested in is there's this one woman that lost her husband, and she's getting pension checks for her husband, and she goes to cash the checks, and there's these four dudes that are always robbing her of her checks, so she can't feed her children. So Mr. T goes there one time and busts them up, and now those guys are out to get revenge, and I want to know what's gonna happen. So yeah, I dig this. I dig this series. It's kind of wacky. It's kind of weird. But there's an underlying message there, and it's good. And Mr. T's involved in it. Like, he was selling this stuff, like I said, on Home Shopping Network, and he was really pushing the book. It only lasted 10 issues, but it seemed to have like great creative team on it, like big names. And I don't know what was the fall. I think it was the fall of Now Comics. But the quality and the paper smell of this era of comics is really nice. It's pretty good newsprint. It's like a really thick mat, actually, more than a newsprint. I liked it a lot. So I highly recommend, if you like Mr. T, to check it out. And I'll be checking out more Green Hornet, The Twilight Zone from Now Comics, Married with Children, Fright Night, and Siphons. Those are the ones that I'm interested in. They were also into like Speed Racer and Astro Boy, but I've never been into that stuff.
Very
Although I did
nice.
like the Speed Racer movie. I really enjoyed that. The live action movie.
I don't think I saw that.
No, I never saw it.
I saw it on IMAX and it was really good and colorful. It was really good 3D type movie to see. So that's it for me.
Nice. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about, and you guys feel free to jump into when I talk. I just want to talk generally about Alpha Flight number 1 through 12, because I'm reading the Alpha Flight by John Byrne omnibus, and I've read the run a couple times before, but it's I don't know why, but it's occurring to me more this time around that I found some of the I mean, I love it, don't get me wrong. I love reading it. I'll be reading it again at some point down the road, but I found it was strange, some of the choices that he made in terms of how he wrote the stories and what happened in the stories, how quickly some things kind of changed. So up to this point, before Alpha Flight 1, Alpha Flight probably had about 7 or 8 appearances, mostly in X-Men and also more than one in Incredible Hulk, mostly Sasquatch in those. But before Alpha Flight number 1, the team was Vindicator, Shaman, Sasquatch, Snowbird, and North Star and Aurora.
Puck.
He was not on the team until Alpha Flight number 1.
Oh, okay.
So him and Marina or Marina, I'm not sure which way you pronounce it, they were part of Beta Flight. And in Alpha Flight number 1, what happens is that there basically some guy got a hold of a ancient native artifact, put it around his head, and basically became like one of the old beasts of an old god kind of Canada called Tundra. So Vindicator changes his name pretty quickly. I'm not sure if he does it in this issue or if it's a couple issues later, but he changes his name to Guardian. And he decides that he kind of wants to go forward and still have a team, even though the government actually is shutting down their relationship with the team. They've shut down the department called Department H, which funded Alpha Flight. So basically he reinstitutes the team and invites both Puck and Marina to join Alpha Flight. So in number 1, they get together. They all individually get this notice from Snowbird that there's a problem up in the very north of Canada. So singly, individually, they're all meeting up with Snowbird there. For the most part, it's not an issue. Snowbird can flies, but so does North Star and Aurora, and obviously the Guardian. Sasquatch jumps on a helicopter and gets somebody to fly him out there. Shaman is actually also in the area. Puck gets the notification, and he runs out to the local Air Force, and he says who he is, and they tell him, no, you need written clearance, otherwise you can't get on a plane. And he runs off trying to find his way there. Bottom line is they end up defeating Tundra and make it back to Guardian's house. His name's James McDonald, and decide that this worked out well, that they want to continue as a team, when the doorbell rings and Puck arrives. So he missed the entire battle is basically what I'm saying. And then in number 2, they're kind of hanging out and just, you know, after they have decided that, okay, they're going to be a team, they're kind of enjoying themselves outside and doing some team building, some practice fighting, and so on and so forth, where Marina starts acting strange, and Puck approaches her, and she basically rips his insides out, and they get him help, get him to a hospital, and the rest of them go after Marina to see what's going on. So again, Puck is not at all in this adventure, just like he wasn't at all in issue number 1. They end up going to the Arctic. At one point, they encounter what's the very badly named villain Master of the World. And it's a horror. I mean, they couldn't think, he couldn't think of a, I mean, I, obviously this whole thing is done, right? I mean, it's not a good name. So they encounter him, they find, they get the, you get the origin of Marina, that, you know, basically she's an alien. She should have been actually, her home world actually launches. Her race conquers other worlds, and her race kind of adapts to whatever planet she's on or they're on to have the best chance of basically taking over each individual world. However, she was on that this particular. Oh, very nice. Allie's got slime. What are you gonna do with it, Allie?
You can make stuff in it.
Uh-huh.
And I already make stuff in
it. Oh, you've been playing?
And I got it from Ross.
Where'd you get it from? You don't remember?
We need to show her that Nickelodeon slime show.
Oh, I know. She's all about slime.
Yeah.
So you're going to go play with your slime?
No, we're going to leave.
You're going to get going?
Becky's getting dressed.
Okay. All right, let me finish telling my story, okay? I know you got a lot. I love you, honey. Okay, bye-bye. Okay, so this spaceship that had crashed up in the Arctic, it was actually Marina's race, and it released all these eggs, and really hers was the only one that ended up surviving. She was found by humans, so that's what she adapted to, but she doesn't know any of this history because everything was damaged. And even though her egg was slightly damaged, she was still viable, but she's not like a conquering race. So Master of the World is telling her this story, also by way of him explaining that it was actually like a caveman. And when he had encountered this crashed spaceship, and they basically took him apart and put him back together. The spaceship took him apart, put him back together until he was actually able to, through his force of will, end up turning the tables and actually controlling the actual mechanisms in the spaceship. So now he's in charge of this. He's the master of the world. And with Submariner, who ends up coming, and Invisible Girl, working with Alpha Flight, they're able to save Marina and defeat the master of the world. But of course, he gets away. At the end of the adventure, Marina decides that she has a lot that she needs to learn about herself, and she goes with Namor to explore basically the seas. So she leaves, and from that point on, we're now up to issue 5. And from issue 5 through issue 10, you have individual single character stories. So for the first time in issue 5, you actually have a story in which Puck does anything at all, because he had been sidelined from issue 1 through 4, literally not in issue 3 or 4. Injured immediately in issue 2, and as I explained, he didn't make it in time in the first issue to do any fighting at all. He showed up again on the last page. So in issue 5, it's his story, and he's basically recovering in the hospital, and he stops an illegal like drug ring that's being conducted with the administrator of the hospital. the next issue is a story focusing on Snowbird, and she encounters another one of these like older gods, and this one is interesting. There's several pages of just white panels with just exposition, whether it's her talking or thinking, or panels or just writing describing what's going on. But that was an interesting issue. And then the next two issues, 7 and 8, are a two-part story with Aurora and Northstar, in which they encounter a gangster who actually kills with a touch, and also encounters a hero that has a sword that's only an atom thick, called Nemesis. And I think that she shows up later on in Alpha Flight, and actually in some later incarnation, she's a member of Alpha Flight after the first volume. Then in issue 9 and 10, it spotlights Sasquatch, where he's helping out with a research expedition up north, and they think that the Thing has come back to Earth from being on an alien planet for after Secret Wars, but it's really the Super Skrull, and then he ends up defeating the Super Skrull. In between, they are showing other things on and off, maybe a page here, a page there of what's going on. Like James Hudson has ended up getting a job with Roxxon and is going to move to New York City. But I guess my point for this is I thought it was interesting that John Byrne ends up having Puck and Marina both join the team. But yet Puck doesn't end up doing anything at all until like issue 5, where it's just single character stories. And Marina, after her very first couple adventures, ends up leaving the team to go with Namor. So I found it strange that he decided to add them from Beta Flight into Alpha Flight, but then does very little with them in the first few issues. I also found it interesting that after issue 5,
Puck shows up more though, right? I mean,
then later on he's starting with issue 11, where it becomes a team story again, he's back in the mix of it. But that's the other thing.
Did you like reading these solo ones?
I actually still love it. I just thought it was like I know that we would never see something like this today, and I just would
in a
like
team
to
book anyway.
Right, and I would like to hear him. Like, I don't know if anyone's ever asked him or talked to him, but I'm sure they have. But I'd love to hear like what exactly his, like why he decided to go with, okay, let's add these people on the team. Okay, they're not hardly even on then, and then let's just do single character stories for like the next 5 or 6 issues. And then 11 and 12, they finally all come together because this woman's been going around picking other members of both Beta and Gamma Flight to make a team called Omega Flight to go up against the Alpha Flight characters, and especially Guardian, because as it's explained, Guardian ended up taking his helmet away from the company he was working for when he found out that they were going to turn it over to the American American military. So basically making the clunkier suit of armor useless without the helmet. This guy took exception to this, the military liaison who worked for the same company as Guardian, and his life kind of fell apart stage by stage after Guardian left the company. And so he ended up trying to kill himself. He was not successful, but now he lost use of his legs. So now he's arranged to have this team, Omega Flight, come together to attack and defeat Alpha Flight. And sorry if this is a spoiler for, you know, a issue that's 30 plus years old, but at the end of issue 12, he finally Guardian defeats Box, who's actually being controlled by this military liaison instead of the guy who actually created it. And Guardian's suit is so damaged that he has to get the power packs off, and he doesn't do it in time, and it explodes, and he dies at the end of issue 12. So really, you have 12 issues of this series, but they only were together for maybe like four or five as a team before the leader is killed. So like reading these so closely back to back this time around, I found it just, I mean, not that I didn't like it, because I still like it. I just found it very unusual that they were barely, at least in, I mean, they had, like I said, eight appearances before this, but for the series itself, they were only together as a team for like maybe four or five issues before he decided to kill Guardian. And I don't know, I found it very, very peculiar that he did so many single character stories, and then he brought them back together. He killed the leader of the team. And then, of course, that's as far as I've gotten right now, although I, you know, had read it in the past, so I know what happens afterwards. But I found it very interesting. I would like to know more about what he was thinking, like what exactly what he decided to try to accomplish in these first 12 issues with so many of these single character stories. But it was, I mean, it was interesting to read. I loved the series. It's just, I'm surprised that I never noticed this before, that it was like, oh, well, okay, Puck and Marina are joining for the first time, but yet they're barely in it before Marina leaves. And she comes back later on too. But I'm like, you know, what exactly was his thoughts at the time when he decided to kind of sideline Puck for four issues? So nobody's actually seen anything that he does until issue five. You know what I mean? And in that, he's a patient in a hospital, very low stakes, just busting up a drug ring. But it, Chris and Mike, have you guys ever read these before?
Nope.
No, so you don't really have a comment on them. Yeah, I just thought it was strange.
I've read them when they were coming out.
So that was a long time ago, my friend.
Yeah, I have. Let's see. I have a full run of all the volumes except for volume one. I think I have like 1 through 60.
Yeah, I got about that for the first run too.
And then at the tail end, I started again. So like I have the last few issues.
It's funny, you say you have like 1 to 60. I've got 1 to 62, and then after that, I only have like two or three more issues, and that's it.
Yeah,
I didn't go back to it though. Yeah, I'd be interested to know if anyone's listening and has more of a history with Alpha Flight, if they've ever heard anything, any interviews with John Byrne about the beginning of Alpha Flight as the series, in terms of any decision with adding those two characters, but then actually having one not really do anything until issue five and having the other one leave pretty much after the second adventure. But still, like I said, I mean, this is probably the third, fourth time that I've read these first 12 issues.
Are you going to complete it?
Yeah, I'm excited because the omnibus actually goes to issue 12.
No, I'm talking about the run.
Oh, no, I don't have any plans for it. You know, honestly, after reading these, if I went to the store and found these in the 50-cent bin, like the ones that I'm missing, I would definitely pick them up. But I'm not going to, I don't think I'm going to go out of my way to buy them for, you know, anywhere over a dollar each.
So. That's all right. I'll do it for you.
All right. Thank you.
I'll have them by the next time we talk.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'd like to know if anyone heard anything more about what his take on this was, but I mean,
I wouldn't because I avoid interviews like the plague. I don't know why it is, but when I see a podcast has an interview, I just skip it.
Skip it.
Yep. I don't know what it is. I said I've only listened to a couple too.
He created here with you know, Claremont, and I think that Byrne had a lot to do with the creation of Alpha Flight from the X-Men issues. But I love those characters. I love the Omega Flight characters. I think that he just did a really good job creating some very interesting characters and fleshing them out.
Yeah, I started that omnibus. I just didn't finish it.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't read past 12 in a very long time. So I've got 13 on deck. So it's going to be interesting to
well, when I read start. 12 when it was coming out, I was pretty shocked. I was like, what? What happened?
And then they did it again in issue 24. Yeah. Nothing stuck, of course, because I think those characters are all around again. But
I thought his wife took over.
Yeah, she ended up taking over as the leader, first as just a civilian leader, and then she ended up
in the armor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was she Vindicator, or what was she, did she change her name?
I don't remember if she called herself also Guardian or if she called herself Vindicator.
Maybe she's Vindicator.
She might be. I think she
changed her name.
I know that
she did. Her and her husband did have like a relationship with Logan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's how they got. He was Weapon Alpha in the very first issue 9 of X-Men.
I just remember the cabin stuff.
Yeah. So he's going back to get Wolverine back because the Canadian government wanted him back. He was supposed to be the leader of Alpha Flight.
Yeah. Poor Logan, they're always screwing him up.
I know.
Hunting him down.
Yep.
Chris,
you got another one?
Yeah, but I'm ready for lunch.
You're getting hungry.
Yep. 1 o'clock's above my limit.
You could do a lightning round on this one book. I challenge you.
That's okay. I'll save it for next time.
Do three-minute synopsis.
No, I'll do it justice next time.
Chris does not bow to peer pressure.
Not when his stomach's growling, obviously.
That takes precedence.
Uh-huh.
You guys can keep going, though, if you want.
Well, that's all that I have.
That's all I have.
Yeah, I got it. So I might as well eat, too.
Yeah.
All right. Hungry. Well, you can reach Chris and ask him what he's eating today at Mythmaking ETC. I'm at Mike Myers Brunch, and Rob is at his is easiest. Rob Krieger, like Seeger, but not spelled like Seeger, but
no,
it's said like.
Took
Seeger.
Me a long time to think of that that Twitter handle, though.
Yeah, I like when it's legit sometimes because then it doesn't obfuscate who you are. But we're at geekbrunchpodcast.com on the website, and you can find us on Facebook under Geek Brunch Podcast. Click the like button, leave comments there. You can also send all your questions to at MythMakingETC because he's looking for questions all the time.
Apparently.
So make sure you send
you,
them
Nick,
to
for
him.
Thank you, all those questions.
Yeah, thank you. They were good. I enjoyed them. It really has me thinking about which artists missed the list, and I'm thinking about another 5 that I could have taken that 5th spot. My 4 are locked in. Like I have 4 artists that are locked in, and then the 5th one could go to any of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm kind of the same.
All right. Well, you guys have a good Sunday. Enjoy the Super Bowl and or whatever you're doing besides the Super Bowl. And we'll talk to you in 2 weeks or so.
Sounds good. All right. Have a great Sunday, guys. Thank you.
Bye.